This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Bullet That Missed, a Thursday Murder Club mystery by Richard Osman. Read for you by Fiona Shaw.
Bethany Waits understands there is no going back now. Time to be brave and to see how this all plays out. She weighs the bullet in her hand. Life is about understanding opportunities. Understanding how rarely they come along, and then rising to meet them when they do. Come and meet me. I just want to talk. That's what the email had said. She has been playing it over in her mind ever since. Should she? One last thing to do before she decides. Send Mike a message. Mike knows the story she's working on. He doesn't know the details. A reporter has to keep her secrets, but he knows it's a risky one. He's there if she needs him. But there are some things you have to do alone. Whatever happens tonight, she would be sad to leave Mike Waghorn behind. He is a good friend, a kind and funny man. That's why the viewers love him. But Bethany dreams of more, and maybe this is her chance. A dangerous chance, but a chance all the same. She writes her message and presses send. He won't reply tonight. It's late. That's probably for the best. She can hear his voice now.
Who texts at 10 p.m? Millennials and sex pests, that's who.
Here we go, then. Time for Bethany to spin the wheel of fortune. Will she live? Or will she die? She pours herself a drink and takes one final look at the bullet. Really, she has no choice at all. Two opportunities. Part 1. Around every corner, a familiar face. Chapter 1.
I don't need makeup, says Ron.
He's in a straight-back chair because Ibrahim told him you mustn't slouch on television. Do you not? Replies his makeup artist, Pauline Jenkins, taking brushes and palettes from her bag. She has set up a mirror on a table in the jigsaw room. It is framed by light bulbs, and the glow bounces off her cerise earrings as they bob back and forth. Ron feels the adrenaline pumping a little.
This is the stuff, a bit of TV. Where are the others, though? He told them they could come along if they fancied, no big deal, and he will be gutted if they don't show. They can take me as they find me, says Ron. I've earned this face. It tells a story.
Horror story, if you don't mind me saying, says Pauline, looking at a colour palette, and then at Ron's face. She blows him a kiss.
Not everyone has to be beautiful, says Ron.
His friends know the interview starts at 4. They'll be here soon, surely. We're agreed there, darling, says Pauline. I'm not a miracle worker. I remember you back in the day, though. Handsome bugger, weren't you? If you like that sort of thing. Ron grunts. And I do like that sort of thing, if I'm honest with you. Right up my street. Always fighting for the working man, weren't you? Throwing your weight around. Pauline opens a compact. You still believe in all that, do you? Up the workers? Ron's shoulders go back a touch, like a bull preparing to enter a ring.
Still believe in it? Still believe in equality? Still believe in the power of labour? What's your name?
Pauline, says Pauline.
Still believe in the dignity of a day's work for a fair day's pay, Pauline? More than ever.
Pauline nods. Good-o. Then shut your mush for 5 minutes and let me do the job I'm paid to do, which is to remind the viewers of Southeast Tonight what a looker you are. Ron's mouth opens, but unusually for him, no words come out. Pauline starts on his foundation without further ado.
dignity? My arse, haven't you got gorgeous eyes? Like Che Guevara, if he worked on the docks.
In his mirror, Ron sees the door to the jigsaw room open. Joyce walks in. He knew she wouldn't let him down, not least because she knows Mike Waghorn will be here. This whole thing was her idea, truth be told. She chose the file. Ron notices that Joyce is wearing a new cardigan. She just can't help herself.
You told us you weren't going to have makeup, Ron, says Joyce.
They make you, says Ron. This is Pauline.
Hello, Pauline, says Joyce. You've got your work cut out there.
I've seen worse, said Pauline. I used to work on Casualty.
The door opens once again. A camera operator walks in, followed by a sound man, followed by a flash of white hair, the quiet swoosh of an expensive suit, and the perfect, masculine yet subtle scent of Mike Waghorn. Ron sees Joyce blush. He would roll his eyes if he wasn't having his concealer applied.
Well, here we all are then, says Mike, his smile as white as his hair. The name's Mike Waghorn, the one and only, except no substitutes.
Ron Ritchie, says Ron.
The same, the very same, says Mike, grasping Ron's hand. Haven't changed a bit, have you? This is like being on safari and seeing a lion up close. Mr. Ritchie, he's a lion of a man, isn't he, Pauline?
He's certainly something or other, agrees Pauline, powdering Ron's cheeks. Ron sees Mike turn his head slowly towards Joyce, slipping off her new cardigan with his eyes.
And who, might I ask, are you?
I'm Joyce Meadowcroft. She practically curtsies.
I should say you are, says Mike. You and the magnificent Mr. Ritchie? A couple then, Joyce?
Oh, God, no. My goodness. The thought, no heavens. No, says Joyce. We're friends. No offense, Ron.
Friends indeed, says Mike. Lucky Ron.
Oh, stop flirting, Mike, says Pauline. No one's interested.
Oh, Joyce be interested, says Ron.
I am, says Joyce to herself, but just loud enough to carry.
The door opens once again, and Ibrahim pokes his head around. Good lad, only Elizabeth missing now.
Am I too late?
You're just in time, says Joyce.
The sound man is attaching a microphone to Ron's lapel. Ron is wearing a jacket over his West Ham shirt at Joyce's insistence. It is unnecessary, in his opinion, sacrilegious, if anything. Ibrahim takes a seat next to Joyce and looks at Mike Waghorn.
You are very handsome, Mr. Waghorn. Classically handsome.
Thank you, says Mike, nodding in agreement. I play squash, I moisturise, and nature takes care of the rest.
And about a grand a week in makeup, says Pauline, putting the finishing touches to Ron.
I am handsome too, it is often remarked upon, says Ibrahim. I think perhaps had my life taken a different turn, I might have been a newsreader too.
I'm not a newsreader, says Mike. I'm a journalist who happens to read the news.
Ibrahim nods.
A fine mind and a nose for a story. Well, that's why I'm here, says Mike. As soon as I read the email, I sniffed a story. A new way of living, retirement communities, the famous face of Ron Ritchie at the heart of it. I thought, yep, viewers will love a bit of that.
It's been quiet for a few weeks, but Ron is delighted that the gang is back in action. The whole interview is a ruse, designed by Joyce to lure Mike Waghorn to Cooper's Chase, to see if he could help them with the case. Joyce sent an email to one of the producers. Even so, it still means that Ron is going to be on TV again, and he is very happy about that.
Will you come to dinner afterwards, Mr. Waghorn? Asked Joyce. We've got a table for 5:30 after the rush.
Please
call me Mike, says Mike. And no, I'm afraid I try not to mix with people, you know, privacy, germs, whatnot. You understand, I'm certain.
Oh, says Joyce. Ron sees her disappointment. If there is a bigger fan of Mike Waghorn anywhere in Kent or Sussex, he would like to meet them. In fact, now he really thinks about it, he wouldn't like to meet them.
There is always a great deal of alcohol, says Ibrahim to Mike, and I suspect many fans of yours will be there.
Mike has been given pause for thought.
And we can tell you all about the Thursday Murder Club, says Joyce.
The Thursday Murder Club, says Mike. Sounds made up.
Everything is made up when you really think about it, says Ibrahim.
The alcohol is subsidized, by the way. They tried to stop the subsidy, but we held a meeting. A number of words were exchanged, and they thought better of it. And we'll have you out by 7:30.
Mike looks at his watch, then looks at Pauline.
Well, we could probably do a quick supper.
Pauline looks at Ron. Will you be there? Ron looks at Joyce, who nods firmly.
Sounds like I will, yeah.
Then we'll stay, says Pauline.
Good, good, says Ibrahim. There's something we'd like to talk to you about, Mike.
Which is? Asks Mike.
All in good time, says Ibrahim. I don't wish to pull focus from Ron.
Mike sits in an armchair opposite Ron and starts counting to 10. Ibrahim leans into Joyce.
He is testing the microphone level. I had to work that out, says Joyce, and Ibrahim nods. Thank you for getting him to stay for dinner. You never know, do you?
You never do know, Joyce, that is true. Perhaps the two of you will marry before the year is out. And even if not, which is an outcome we must prepare for, I'm sure he will have plenty of information about Bethany Waits.
The door opens once more, and Elizabeth enters the room. The gang is all here. Ron pretends he is not touched. Last time he had a gang of friends like these, they were being hospitalized by police riot shields at the Wapping print workers' strike. Happy days.
Don't mind me, says Elizabeth. You look different, Ron. What is it? You look healthy.
Ron grunts, but sees Pauline's smile. That's a cracking smile, to be fair to her. Is Pauline in his league? Late 60s, a bit young for him. What league is he in these days? It's been a long time since he checked. Either way, what a smile.
Chapter 2. It can be hard to run a multi-million-pound drugs gang from a prison cell. But it is not, as Connie Johnson is discovering, impossible. Most of the prison staff are on side, and why wouldn't they be? She throws enough money around. There are still a couple of guards who won't play ball, however, and Connie has already had to swallow 2 illegal SIM cards this week. The diamonds, the murders, the bag of cocaine. She had been very skillfully set up, and her trial date has been set for 2 months' time. She is eager to keep things ticking over until then. Perhaps she'll be found guilty, perhaps she won't, but Connie likes to err on the side of optimism in all things. Plan for success, her mum used to say, although soon afterwards she died, having been hit by an uninsured van. Above all, it's good to keep busy. Routine is important in prison. Also, it is important to have things to look forward to, and Connie is looking forward to killing Bogdan. He's the reason she's in here. And eyes like mountain pools or not, he is going to have to go. And the old guy, too. The one who helped Bogdan set her up. She's asked around and found his name is Ron Ritchie. He'll have to go as well. She'll leave them until after the trial. Juries don't like witnesses being murdered. But then she will kill them both. Looking down at her phone, Connie sees that one of the men who works in the prison admin block is on Tinder. He is balding
and standing next to what appears to be a Volvo of all things, but she swipes right regardless because you never know when people might come in handy. She sees immediately that they are a match. Kel Surprise. Connie has done a bit of research into Ron Ritchie. He was famous, apparently, back in the 70s and 80s. She looks at the picture of him on her phone, his face like an unsuccessful boxer shouting into a megaphone. Clearly a man who enjoyed the limelight. Lucky you, Ron Ritchie, thinks Connie. You'll be famous again by the time I've finished with you. One thing is for sure. Connie will do anything she can to remain in prison for as short a time as possible, and once she is out, the mayhem can really begin. Sometimes in life, you simply have to be patient. Through her barred window, Connie looks out over the prison yard and to the hills beyond. She switches on her Nespresso machine. Chapter 3. Mike and Pauline have joined them for dinner. Ibrahim loves it when the whole gang is together. Together and with a mission in mind. Joyce had been adamant that they were to investigate the Bethany Waits case. Ibrahim was quick to agree. Firstly, because it is an interesting case, an unsolved case, but mainly because Ibrahim has fallen in love with Joyce's new dog, Alan, and he is worried that if he upsets her, Joyce might restrict his access.
You want to drop a red, Mike? Ron asks, bottle raised.
What is it? Asks Mike.
How do you mean?
What wine is it? Ron shrugs.
It's red. I don't know the make.
Okay, let's live dangerously just this once, says Mike, and lets Ron pour. They have been very keen to talk to Mike Waghorn about the murder of Bethany Waits. It is assumed that he will have information that was not in the official police files. Mike doesn't know that yet, of course. He is just enjoying free wine with four harmless pensioners. Ibrahim will be patient before he starts asking about the murder because he knows that Joyce is excited to meet Mike and she has lots of other questions for him first. She has written them down in a notebook, which is in her handbag, in case she forgets any of them. Now that Mike has a glass of unidentified red in front of him, Joyce clearly feels able to begin.
When you read the news, Mike, is it all written down, or are you allowed to put it in your own words?
That's an excellent question, says Mike. Perceptive. Gets right to the heart of things. It is all written down, but I don't always stick to the script.
You've earned that right over the years, says Joyce, and Mike agrees.
Get me into trouble from time to time, though, says Mike. They made me go on an impartiality course in Thanet.
Good for you, says Elizabeth.
Ibrahim sees Joyce take a sneaky peek at the notebook in her handbag.
Do you ever wear any special clothes when you read the news? Asks Joyce. Special socks or anything?
No, says Mike.
Joyce nods, a little disappointed, then takes another look at her book.
What happens if you need the loo during a show?
For heaven's sake, Joyce, says Elizabeth. I go before the show starts, says Mike.
Fun though this is, Ibrahim wonders if it isn't time to kick off this evening's proceedings himself.
So, Mike, we have a...
Joyce places a hand on his arm.
Ibrahim, forgive me, just a couple more things. What is Amber like?
Who's Amber? Says Ron.
Mike's co-host, says Joyce. Honestly, Ron, you're embarrassing yourself.
I do that, says Ron.
He says this directly to Pauline, who, in Ibrahim's opinion, had very deliberately sat next to Ron at the start of dinner. Ibrahim usually sits next to Ron, no matter.
She's only been there 3 years, but I'm already starting to like her, says Joyce.
She's terrific, says Mike. Goes to the gym a lot, but terrific.
She has lovely hair, too, says Joyce.
Joyce, you should judge news presenters on their journalism, says Mike, and not their appearance. Female presenters, particularly, have to put up with that a lot.
Joyce nods, knocks back half a glass of wine, then nods again. I do take your point, Mike. I just think that you can be very talented and have lovely hair. Perhaps I'm shallow, but both of these things are important to me. Claudia Winkleman is a good example. You also have lovely hair.
I'll have the steak, please, says Mike to the waiter, now taking their orders. Rare to medium rare, err on the side of rare, though if you err on the side of medium, I'll live. I had read you were a Buddhist, Mike, Ibrahim spent the morning researching their guest. I am, says Mike, 30-odd years.
Ah, says Ibrahim,
I had been under the impression that Buddhists were vegetarian. I was almost sure. I'm Church of England too, says Mike, so I pick and choose. That's the point of being a Buddhist.
I stand corrected, says Ibrahim. Mike has started on his second glass of red and seems ready to hold court. This is perfect.
Tell me about this Thursday murder club, then, he says.
It's fairly hush-hush, says Ibrahim. But we meet up once a week, the four of us, to look over old police files, see if we can solve anything they were unable to.
Sounds like a fun hobby, says Mike. Looking into old murders keeps you busy, I bet. The old grey cells ticking over. Ron, should we get another bottle of this red?
It's mainly been new murders recently, says Elizabeth, laying the bait still further. Mike laughs. He clearly doesn't think Elizabeth is being serious, which is probably for the best. Don't want to frighten him off just yet.
Sounds like you don't mind a bit of trouble here and there, says Mike.
I've always been a magnet for trouble, says Ron. Pauline tops up Ron's glass.
Well, watch yourself, Ron, because I've always been trouble.
Ibrahim sees Joyce give a tiny secret smile at this. Ibrahim decides that before they try to move the conversation gently and slowly on to Bethany Waits, he has a question of his own. He turns to Pauline.
Are you married, Pauline? He asks.
Widow, says Pauline.
Oh, snap, says Joyce.
Ibrahim notes that this evening's combination of wine and celebrity is making her quite the giddy goat.
How long have you been on your own? Asks Elizabeth.
6 months, says Pauline.
6 months? That's no time at all, says Joyce, placing her hand on Pauline's. I was still putting an extra slice in the toaster at 6 months.
Was it time?
Here goes, thinks Ibrahim. Time to make small, subtle shifts in the conversation so they can start talking about Bethany Waits, a delicate dance with Ibrahim as master choreographer. He has his first move all planned.
So, Mike, I wonder if you...
I'll tell you this for nothing, says Mike, ignoring Ibrahim, wine glass circling the air. If you want a murder to solve, I've got a name for you.
Go on, says Joyce.
Bethany Waits, says Mike.
Mike is on board. The Thursday Murder Club always get their man. Ibrahim notes, and not for the first time, that people often seem very willing to walk into their traps. Mike takes them through the story they already know from the police files. They nod along, pretending it's all new to them. The brilliant young reporter, Bethany Waits, the big story she was investigating, a massive VAT fraud, and then her unexplained death. Her car driving off Shakespeare Cliff in the dead of night. But there is nothing new. Mike is currently showing them the final message Bethany sent him the night before she died.
I don't say this often enough. But thank you.
Touching, certainly. But also nothing they don't already know. Perhaps the biggest revelation they are going to get from this evening is that Mike Waghorn goes to the toilet before he goes on air. Ibrahim decides to chance his arm.
What about messages
in a few weeks before that. Anything out of the ordinary? Anything the police haven't seen?
Mike scrolls back through his messages, reading some highlights.
Do I fancy a pint? Have I watched Line of Duty? There's one about the story she was working on here, but from a couple of weeks before. Interested?
One never knows what might help, says Elizabeth, pouring Mike another glass of red. Mike reads from his phone.
Skipper, that's what she used to call me.
Among other things, says Pauline.
Some new info, can't say what, but it's absolute dynamite. Getting closer to the heart of this thing.
Elizabeth nods. And did she ever tell you what the new information was?
She did not, says Mike. I'll tell you what, this red is half decent.
Chapter 4. PC Donna de Freitas feels like someone has just punched a hole through the clouds. She is flooded with heat and warmth, alive with a pleasure both utterly familiar but completely new. She wants to weep with happiness and to laugh with the uncomplicated joy of life. If she has ever felt happier, she cannot immediately bring it to mind. If the angels were to carry her away this very moment, and if her heart rate was anything to go by, that was a possibility. She would let them scoop her up while she thanked the heavens for a life well lived.
How was it?
Asked Bogdan, his hand stroking her hair.
It was okay, says Donna, for a first time.
Bogdan nods.
I think maybe I can be better.
Donna buries her head into Bogdan's chest.
Are you crying?
Asks Bogdan. Donna shakes her head without lifting it. Where's the catch here? Perhaps this is just a one-night thing. What if that's Bogdan's style? He's kind of a loner, isn't he? What if he's emotionally unavailable? What if there's another girl in this bed tomorrow night? White and blonde and 22. What was he thinking? That was the one question she knew not to ask a man. They were almost always thinking nothing at all. So were thrown by the question and felt compelled to make something up. She'd still like to know, though. What was going on behind those blue eyes, eyes that could nail you to a wall, the pure blue of... Wait a minute. Is he crying? Donna sits up, concerned.
Are you crying?
Bogdan nods.
Why are you crying? What's happened?
Bogdan looks at her through his gentle tears.
I'm so happy. You're here.
Donna kisses a tear from his cheek.
Has anyone ever seen you cry before?
A dentist once, says Bogdan, and my mother. Can we go on another date?
Oh, I think so, don't you? Says Donna.
I think so, agrees Bogdan.
Donna rests her head on his chest again, comfortably settling on a tattoo of a knife wrapped in barbed wire. Maybe next time we do something other than Nando's and Laser Quest, though.
Agreed, says Bogdan. Next time, perhaps, I should choose instead.
I think that's for the best, yes, says Donna. It's not my strong point. But you had fun?
Sure. I liked Laser Quest.
You really did, didn't you? Says Donna.
That children's birthday party didn't know what had hit them.
It's a good lesson for them, says Bogdan. Fighting is mainly hiding. It's good to learn that early.
Donna looks over at Bogdan's bedside table. There is a bodybuilder's hand grip, a can of Lilt, and the plastic gold medal he won at Laser Quest. What has she found herself here? A fellow traveller?
Do you ever feel different from other people, Bogdan? Like you're outside looking in?
Well, English is my second language, says Bogdan, and I don't really understand cricket. Do you feel different?
Yes, said Donna. People make me feel different, I suppose.
But sometimes you like to feel different, maybe. Sometimes it's good.
Sometimes, of course, I'd like to choose those times myself. Most days, I just want to blend in. But in Fairhaven, I don't get the chance.
Everyone wants to feel special, but nobody wants to feel different, says Bogdan.
Just look at those shoulders. Two questions come to her at once. Are Polish weddings like English weddings? And would it be okay if I rolled over and went to sleep?
Can I ask you a question, Donna? Bogdan suddenly sounds very serious. Uh-oh.
Of course, says Donna. Anything. Anything within reason.
If you had to murder someone, how would you do it?
Hypothetically, asked Donna.
No, for real, says Bogdan. We are not children. You're a police officer. How would you do it? To get away with it?
Is this Bogdan's downside? He's a serial murderer? That would be tough to overlook. Not impossible, though, given those shoulders. What's happening here? Asked Donna. Why are you asking me that?
It's homework for Elizabeth. She wanted to know my thoughts.
Okay, that makes sense. What a relief. Bogdan is not a homicidal maniac. Elizabeth is. Poison, I suppose, says Donna. Something undetectable, anyway.
Yes. Make it look natural, agrees Bogdan. Make it look like not a murder.
Maybe drive a car at them late at night, says Donna. Anything where you don't have to touch the body, that's where forensics will get you. Or a gun, nice and simple. One shot, blam, and get out quick, the whole thing away from security cameras. Plan your escape route, of course, that's essential too. No forensics, no witnesses, no body to bury, that's how I do it. Phone off, or leave your phone in a cab, so it's miles away when you're committing the murder. Bribe a nurse. Maybe get vials of blood from strangers and leave them on the body, or... Bogdan is looking at her. Has she overshared there? Maybe move the conversation on. What's Elizabeth up to?
She says someone got murdered.
Of course she does, says Donna.
But murdered in a car pushed off a cliff is not how I'd murder someone.
A car over a cliff. Okay, I can see that, says Donna. Why is Elizabeth investigating it?
Bogdan shrugs. Because Joyce wanted to meet someone off the TV, I think. I didn't really understand.
Donna nods. That sounds about right. Were there any marks on the body, like they'd been killed before the car went over the cliff?
No body. Just some clothes and some blood. The body was thrown from the car.
That's convenient for the killer. Donna was not used to this type of post-coital talk. Usually you had to hear about someone's motorbike, or the ex whom they just realized they still loved, or you had to give a reassuring pep talk. Spectacular, though, if the killer wanted to send a message to someone. Difficult to ignore.
I think it's too complicated, says Bogdan. For a murder, a car, a cliff, come on.
And you're an expert in murder now?
I read a lot, says Bogdan.
What's your favourite book ever?
The Velveteen Rabbit, says Bogdan, or Andre Agassi's autobiography.
Maybe Bogdan could kill Carl, her ex. She's fantasized about killing Carl a few times. Could Bogdan push Carl's stupid master over a cliff? But even as the thought flashes through her mind and she stretches like a cat finding a patch of sunshine, she realizes she no longer cares about Carl. Be the bigger person, Donna. Let Carl live.
She could have asked me and Chris to help, says Donna. We'd have been able to take a look at it. Do you remember the name?
Bogdan shrugs. Bethany, oh, something. But they like to do these things by themselves.
Don't they just, agrees Donna and throws her arm across his endless chest. Rarely has she felt so thrillingly puny.
I like talking about murder with you, Bogdan.
I like talking about murder with you too, Donna. Although I don't think this was murder. Too convenient.
Donna looks up one more time into those eyes. Bogdan, do you promise that's not the last time we're ever going to have sex? Because I'd really like to go to sleep now and then wake up with you and do it again.
I promise, says Bogdan, his hands stroking her hair.
This is how you're supposed to fall asleep, thinks Donna. How has she not known about this before? Safe and happy and sated. And murders. And Elizabeth and tattoos. And being different and being the same. And cars and cliffs and clothes. And tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Chapter 5. Joyce. I will admit that the murder of Bethany Waits was my idea. We were all looking through the files for a new Thursday Murder Club case. There was a spinster in Rye in the early 80s, for example, who had died leaving three unidentified skeletons and a suitcase containing £50,000 in her cellar. That was Elizabeth's favourite, and I agree, it would have been quite jolly, but as soon as I saw the name, Bethany Waits, on another file, my mind was made up. I don't put my foot down often, but when I do, it stays down. Elizabeth sulked, but the others knew not to argue. I'm not just here for tea and biscuits, you know. I remembered Bethany Waits, of course, and I had read a piece Mike Waghorn had written in the Kent Messenger about her murder. So I thought to myself, hello, Joyce, this looks suspicious, and you might get to meet Mike Waghorn. Is that so wrong? I have been watching Mike Waghorn on South East Tonight for as long as I can remember. If anyone gets murdered or opens a fate anywhere in the South East, Mike will be there with that big smile on his face. Actually, he doesn't smile for the murders. Then he does a serious face, which he is also very good at. I actually prefer his serious face, so if there has been a murder, at least that's a silver lining. He looks a little bit like if Michael Bublé were more my age. Mike has done South East Tonight for 35 years now. But every 5 years or so, they get a new woman to host it with him, which is where Bethany Waits came in. Bethany Waits was blonde and northern, and she died in a car that drove over Shakespeare Cliff near Dover. It's just off the A20. I looked it up because I suspect we'll be going there at some point. This must have been almost 10 years ago. You would have thought it was just a suicide, cliffs and cars and what have you, but there are all sorts of other things. Someone had been seen in the car with her just beforehand. There were ambiguous messages on her phone. The waters were muddied. So the police called it murder, and looking through their files, we were inclined to agree. It was very big news around here at the time. Not an awful lot happens in Kent, so you can imagine. They had a special tribute show, and I remember Mike crying and Fiona Clemens having to put an arm around him on air. Fiona was the new co-host by then. Fiona Clemens is so famous now. Lots of people don't realise she started on Southeast Tonight. I asked Mike if he watches her quiz Stop the Clock, but he said he doesn't, which must make him the only one in the country who doesn't. Pauline, she's the makeup artist, and we will get back to her, said he's just jealous. But Mike said he doesn't watch TV. I will be honest with you. I'd hoped that this evening I would flirt with Mike, and he would tell me how much he liked my necklace, and I would blush and giggle, and Elizabeth would roll her eyes. But nothing doing, I'm afraid. All wag, no horn, was how Ron put it. Mike gave me a peck on the cheek, and at one point he brushed my hand, and there was electricity. But I think that was the combination of the deep carpet outside the restaurant and my new cardigan. He interviewed Ron this afternoon. They're doing a piece about retirement living on Southeast Today. This was all Elizabeth's suggestion. She made me email one of the producers. If you want to lure someone, go to Elizabeth. I have to admit, Ron was actually rather good. He knows when to turn it on. He talked about loneliness and friendship and security, and I was very proud of him for being so open. You can see that Ibrahim rubs off on him. At one point, he got distracted and started talking about West Ham, but Mike steered him back on course. What we really wanted out of this whole plan, though, was information about Bethany Waits, and Mike was certainly happy to chat. He was three sheets of the wind, and he told us a lot of things we already knew from the files, but he was fired up. The basic facts are these. Bethany had been investigating a huge VAT fraud to do with importing and exporting mobile phones. The scheme had made millions. A woman named Heather Garbutt had been behind it. She worked for a man named Jack Mason, a local crook, and it was widely believed that she was managing the operation on his behalf. Heather later went to jail for the fraud, but Jack Mason did not. Lucky Jack Mason. One March evening, Bethany had sent Mike a text message, and Mike had expected to see her bright and breezy the next morning. But the next morning was never to come for Bethany. That night, she had been seen leaving her apartment building, we used to call it a block of flats, didn't we, at about 10 p.m, and had then gone AWOL for several hours, no one knows where. She next reappeared on a CCTV camera near Shakespeare Cliff at nearly 3 a.m. She had an unidentified passenger in her car. The next time the car is seen is at the bottom of Shakespeare Cliff, wrecked and containing her blood and her clothes, but not her body, which makes me suspicious, but is apparently common with the tides around there. A year later, without the faintest sign of her, and with her bank accounts having not been touched, a presumption of death certificate had been issued. Again, par for the course, but still you must ask yourself, where's the body? I didn't say that out loud to Mike, because you can tell Bethany Waits means a great deal to him. He gave us one new piece of information, a text message Bethany had sent him. She had discovered some new evidence, something important. Mike never found out what it was. Heather Garbutt was obviously the key suspect with all the evidence Bethany had been gathering about her, but they couldn't link her to Bethany's death in any way. Try as they might, they couldn't link Jack Mason either. Soon enough, Heather Garbutt was put in prison for fraud, and everyone moved on to something else, but Mike never moved on. The key questions, as Mike sees them, are, what was the new evidence Bethany messaged him about? It was nowhere in the court documents. But had she kept a record somewhere? Would it link Jack Mason to the crime, maybe? He is still a free man today. A very rich one, too. Why did Bethany leave her apartment at 10 p.m. that evening? Was she going to meet someone? To confront someone? And why did it take her more than 4 hours to reach Shakespeare Cliff? She must have stopped somewhere. But where? Did she meet someone? And finally, of course, who was the passenger in her car? There's enough for us to be getting on with there. I could tell even Elizabeth was taking an interest by the end. After that, we all had a few more drinks. Pauline and Ron shared a dessert, which might sound normal to you, but I've never seen Ron willingly share food, let alone a banoffee pie. So, watch this space. Before we knew it, it was nearly 8 p.m. Alan was beside himself when I got in. I say beside himself. He was curled up on the sofa and raised an eyebrow at me that said, "What sort of time is this for my dinner, you dirty stop-out? You know how dogs can be." I had brought him back some steak, though, so that soon changed his tune. He wolfed it down without a backwards glance. Alan is many things, but he is clearly not a Buddhist. I am Googling Heather Garbutt and listening to the World Service. She is difficult to Google because there's also an Australian hockey player called Heather Garbutt, and most of the results are about her. I actually ended up quite interested in the hockey player, and I follow her on Instagram now. She has 3 very beautiful children. Heather Garbutt is still in prison. Not the hockey player, but you know that. In fact, it turns out she is in Darwell prison, which might work out very nicely for all concerned, because, of course, we already know someone in Darwell prison. I've messaged Ibrahim with an idea that he will like very much. They are talking about cryptocurrency on the World Service now, so I'm going to look that up too. Bitcoin, that's the big one. It sounds very interesting, and it's all the rage according to this program, but quite risky. They just spoke to someone who made a million from it before his 16th birthday, and he was all in favor. Jerry and I used to have some premium bonds, but that's as far as I've experimented with money. Maybe I should live a little, do something different, be someone different. Different to what, though? Who am I? Who am I? I'm Joyce Meadowcroft, and that will do me to be getting on with. Nighttime is for questions without answers, and I have no time for questions without answers. Leave that to Ibrahim. I like questions you can answer. Who killed Bethany Waits? Now, that's a proper question. Chapter 6. Morning has broken at Cooper's Chase. From the window of Elizabeth's flat, you can see the dog walkers and a few latecomers rushing to over 80 Zumba. The air hums with friendly greetings and the sounds of birdsong and Amazon delivery vans. "Why you keep looking at your phone?" asked Bogdan. He is sitting across the chessboard from Stephen, but has been distracted by Elizabeth. "I get messages, dear," says Elizabeth. "I have friends." "You only get messages from Joyce," says Bogdan, "or me, and we are both here." Stephen makes a move. "There you go, champ." "He's quite right," says Joyce, sipping from a mug. "Is this tea Yorkshire?" Elizabeth gives a "how on earth would I know" shrug and goes back to the documents laid out in front of her. Evidence from the trial of Heather Garbutt, readily available to the public if you're happy to wait 3 months or so, or readily available in a couple of hours if you are Elizabeth. She must stop looking at her phone. The last message had read, "You can't ignore me forever, Elizabeth. We have a lot to speak about." She has started receiving threatening messages from an anonymous number. The first had arrived yesterday, and it read,
"Elizabeth, I know what you've done."
Well, you could narrow it down a bit, she had thought. More had come through since. Who was sending her these messages, and more importantly, why? No point worrying about it now, though. No doubt all would become clear eventually, and in the meantime, she has the murder of Bethany Waits to solve.
"I really think it is Yorkshire," Joyce again. "I'm almost sure. You must know."
Elizabeth continues to look through the documents, financial records, dense and unyielding, paper trails showing non-existent mobile phones leaving the docks at Dover, and the same non-existent phones coming back weeks later, reams and reams of VAT claims, bank statements totaling millions, money disappearing to offshore accounts, and then nothing. Bethany Waits had uncovered the lot. You have to admire it.
"Never mind," says Joyce. "You're busy. I'll take a look in the cupboard."
Elizabeth nods. This paperwork was enough to get Heather Garber convicted of fraud, but did it also contain a clue to Bethany Waits' death? If it did, no one had yet found it. Elizabeth didn't fancy her own chances either, not really her area, all this. So what to do? She has a thought.
"Yes, it's Yorkshire," shouts Joyce from the kitchen. "I knew it."
Joyce had been insistent that she was coming round to visit, and it doesn't matter how high up one might have been in MI5 or MI6, it doesn't matter how many times you've been shot at by a sniper or met the Queen, you won't stop Joyce once she has her mind set on something. Elizabeth had acted quickly. Stephen's dementia is getting worse. Elizabeth knows that. But the more he slips from her grasp, the tighter she wants to hold him. If she is looking at him, surely he can't disappear. Stephen is at his very best when Bogdan comes round to play chess, so Elizabeth has invited Bogdan over and taken the risk with Joyce. Perhaps he will be on fine form. And perhaps that will be enough to keep the charade going for another few weeks. She has given Stephen a shave and washed his hair. He no longer finds this unusual. Elizabeth looks over to the chessboard. Bogdan has his chin in his hands, contemplating his next move. There's something different about him.
"Are you using a different shard gel, Bogdan?" Elizabeth asks.
"Don't put the boy off," says Stephen. "I have him in a funk here." "I used an unperfumed body scrub," says Bogdan. "He's new."
"Hmm," says Elizabeth. "That's not it." "It's very feminine," says Joyce. "It's not unperfumed."
"I play chess," says Bogdan. "No distractions, please."
"I feel like you're keeping a secret," says Elizabeth. "Stephen, is Bogdan keeping a secret?"
"Lips are sealed," says Stephen.
Elizabeth returns to the documents. Something here got Bethany Waits killed. By Heather Garbutt? Elizabeth doubts it very much. Heather Garbutt's boss, Jack Mason, is ostensibly a scrap metal dealer, but in reality is one of the most well-connected criminals on the South Coast. Heather Garbutt seems like a soldier, not a general. So was Jack Mason the general? Is his name somewhere in these papers? Time for her plan B.
"How's Joanna, Joyce?"
Elizabeth asks. Joanna is Joyce's daughter.
"She's doing a skydive for cancer," says Joyce.
"Be lovely to catch up with her," says Elizabeth.
Joyce sees straight through this.
"Do you mean it would be lovely for her to take a look through those documents because you don't understand them?"
"Wouldn't do any harm, would it?"
Joanna and her colleagues will get through this stuff in no time, Elizabeth is sure, maybe turn up a name or two.
"I'll ask her," says Joyce. "I'm in her bad books because I said I didn't see the point of sushi."
"Why do you keep looking at your phone, by the way?"
"Don't be tiresome, Joyce," says Elizabeth. "You're not Miss Marple."
On cue, Elizabeth's phone buzzes. She doesn't look. Joyce nails her with the minutest raise of an eyebrow, then turns to Stephen with a much gentler look.
It's very nice to see you, Stephen, says Joyce.
Always nice to meet one of Elizabeth's friends, says Stephen, looking up. You pop round any time. New faces always welcome.
Joyce doesn't react, but Elizabeth knows what she has heard. Bogdan makes a move and Stephen gives a gentle round of applause.
He might smell different, says Stephen, but he doesn't play different.
I don't smell different, says Bogdan.
You do, says Joyce.
Elizabeth takes the opportunity to sneak a look at her phone. I have a job for you. Elizabeth feels the blood pumping. Things have been too quiet recently. A retired optometrist crashed his moped into a tree, and there has been a row about milk bottles. But that was about it for excitement. The simple life is all well and good. But in this moment, with a murder to investigate and threatening texts arriving daily, Elizabeth realizes that she has missed trouble. Chapter 7. DCI Chris Hudson is walking along a freezing cold beach in a howling gale. He is nursing a lukewarm cup of something approximating tea. He has just bought it from a seafront cafe that refused to give him change or let him use the staff toilet. But nothing can ruin his mood, for once things are going very well for Chris. The scenes of crime officer pokes her head out from inside the burned-out minibus currently squatting among the seaweed in the pebbles like a dreadful crab. Won't be a moment. Chris gives a no-bother wave and means it. Why is Chris so happy? The answer is simple, but also complicated. Chris is in love with someone, and that someone is in love with him. No doubt it will all implode at some point, but it hasn't imploded yet. A crisp packet performing acrobatics in the air blows into his face. Love. You just can't beat it. Perhaps it won't implode at all. Is that possible? Perhaps this is it now. Chris and Patrice. Patrice and Chris. Chris narrowly avoids stepping on one of the many needles strewn alongside the minibus. Heroin addicts love the beach. Perhaps he will grow old with Patrice, watching box sets and going to farmers' markets. One hand, one heart. She has just made him watch West Side Story, and it actually wasn't bad once you got past the singing and dancing. Wouldn't that be a thing? He looks over at PC Donna De Freitas, almost doubled up against the wind, face barely visible through the hood of her waterproof coat. She is his partner. Officially still his shadow, but that doesn't seem to be how their relationship works. And she is Patrice's daughter. What a lot he owes her already. Donna also seems quite happy despite the weather. She turns her back to the wind and, pulling off a glove with her teeth, starts to reply to a message she has just been sent. Donna had a date last night and has been very coy about the whole thing. Chris is not certain it went well, but he caught her humming A Whole New World in the car over here, so he has his suspicions. Perhaps Patrice will be able to find out who the mystery man is. The minibus, now just a twisted, melted frame, coal black against the grey of the sea and sky, had belonged to a children's home. The corpse in the driver's seat is, as yet, unidentified. Chris has never really thought about how beautiful the sea is before. His foot crunches the broken neck of a beer bottle. The wind picks up still further, blowing icy needles into Chris's face. Glorious when you stop to look at it, when you drink it all in. Chris has also lost a stone and a half in weight. He recently bought himself a T-shirt in size L instead of his usual XL, or occasional shameful XXL. He eats salmon and broccoli now.
He eats so much broccoli, he can spell it without looking it up. When was the last time he had a Toblerone? He can't even remember. Chris's phone buzzes. Donna is not the only one who can be sent mystery messages. Checking the name, he sees it is from Ibrahim. If Elizabeth messages, you know you should worry. When it's Ibrahim, it's 50-50. He reads, "Good afternoon, Chris. It is Ibrahim here. I hope I haven't messaged you at an inconvenient time. One never knows the schedules of others, let alone those working in law enforcement, where hours are irregular at best." There are dots indicating Ibrahim is working his way through a second message. Chris can wait. 6 months ago, none of this was his. There was no Patrice, there was no Donna, there was no Thursday Murder Club. In fact, he realizes, it all started with them. They carried a kind of magic, the four of them. Sure, they recently condemned two men to their death on Fairhaven Pier and stole an unimaginable amount of money, but they carried a kind of magic all the same. "Who are you texting?" he calls to Donna over the sound of the wind. Might as well give it a go. "Beyonce," shouts Donna, and keeps typing. Chris's phone buzzes, Ibrahim again. "I was wondering, and forgive me if this is outside the ambit of our friendship,